We're with really a legend out of a blues legend out of Austin, Texas. We're with the one and only Denny Freeman. I'm real honored and privileged that he's joining us today. Denny's originally from Dallas. He went to college in North Texas, and then he spent a brief period of time out in LA. In 1970, he moved down to Austin, Texas, where loads of other people were musicians were migrating, guys like Jimmy Vaughn, Doyle Bramhall Sr., and then Stevie Ray Vaughan soon followed. And basically, you know, as Denny explained it to me, if you were a musician at that time or part of that subculture or just a long hair, Austin was kind of the place to be in that part of the world at that time, because it was really just a great community of young folks, very hospitable, very communal, lots of pretty girls, cheap rent, eclectic, open atmosphere, very laid back. And it was kind of like, I guess, what Greenwich Village was probably like in the 60s or late 60s, early 70s, not much different. Musically, though, everybody pretty much had one thing in common, was that they all came ready to play the blues. Denny wound up living and playing with both Jimmy and Stevie Vaughan on and off through the 70s and 80s. You know, the concentration of guys came down to play blues, but the rest of the population really had not been exposed to that for some reason locally. So there was a lot of opportunity for these guys to play. They became friends, roommates, and bandmates, and were constantly gigging. Denny played with Jimmy Vaughan's first Austin band, which was called Storm. And then he got to play on a regular basis for a couple of years with Stevie when he joined Stevie's band, the Cobras, in 1975. He also played with Austin vocalist Luann Barton and Angela Shrelly. In the 80s, Denny was part of a house band at Antone's, backing up blues giants like Otis Rush, Albert Collins, Buddy Guy, Junior Wells, Jimmy Rogers, Eddie Taylor, Lazy Lester, and many more. How's that for a cast of people to play with, man? That's pretty cool. Primarily a guitar player, Denny's actually also a piano and organ player, and he's made six CDs of his own, and he's also played organ and piano on other people's records and gigs over the years, including James Cotton and Jimmy Vaughan's albums. He also toured on Jimmy Vaughan's first solo outing as the piano player. Denny wrote or co-wrote a track on Debbie Harry's No Exit album, and with Jimmy and Stevie Ray Vaughan for the Vaughan Brothers Family Style album, he had co-writes there as well. After touring for a year and a half with Jimmy in the mid-90s, he then toured with Taj Mahal and the Phantom Blues Band until late 2002. He was playing guitar then, and it was during that period of time that Taj had his Grammy-winning CD called Shouting in Key, or Shouting in Key, I should say, and Denny wound up touring the world with Taj for that album. He played in the Bob Dylan Band from 2005 till 2009, and he plays on the Bob Dylan album Modern Times and on miscellaneous tracks on other Dylan albums. In October 2011, he moved back to Austin, and he plays around town quite a bit now, and I'll tell you about some of his gigs later on. His latest album was released in October 2012, and that was called Diggin' on Dylan, which is a collection of 16 Bob Dylan songs played as instrumentals and interpreted by Denny. And in 2009, Denny was justly inducted into the Austin Music Hall of Fame. And I want to tell you also, the person who turned me on to Denny was Ian Moore, whose interview was really popular. If you want to go listen to that, it's episode number 285, and you can look it up on everyonelovesguitar.com. And I want to be upfront with you and tell you that, and Denny would never say this, but Ian was on the scene in Austin back then, and he said Denny was a tremendous influence on the playing of both Jimmy and Stevie Ray Vaughan and on all the other players there. And I think Denny, at least in my early conversation with him last time we spoke, was probably more modest about that than he could be. So, man, with that being said, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you coming on the show, man.
Thanks, Greg.
So you lived in LA a couple of different times, and I was curious what prompted you to move out there and then leave the first time and come back to Austin.
Well, it's a long, tedious, complicated story. I'll try to, it's hard to make it concise, but I'll try. Everything goes, so much of my life in my early life, everything that happened from 1962 until 1970 was determined by the situation of the draft and how I had to respond or react to that reality. Because I got out of high school, I'm old, I got out of high school in 62, there was a draft. And nobody had heard of, well, certainly not me, had heard of Vietnam at the time. But whether I had or I, all I knew was I was 17 when I got out of high school, turned 18 the summer right after that. And almost the only thing I knew at that point in my life was I liked playing guitar and I didn't want to get drafted. That's about all I knew. And the only way to avoid getting drafted, I mean, if we were fighting Nazis, I hope that I would have just joined and not had to wait to be drafted. But we weren't fighting a war in 62. And I wanted to stay out late and chase girls and play music. I didn't want to go to boot camp, you know, when I was 18 years old. But if I did those things, I would end up in boot camp, because in 1962, that was a few years before people my age and in my situation were going, I'm not going, you know.
Yeah.
But none of the alternatives were good. None of them were. I mean, I didn't want to move to Canada. In 1962, you didn't think about those things. You either went go to college, or there was a few things you could do to avoid the draft. And I said, well, okay. I didn't really care about college or know why I wanted to go there, but I said, well, if it's the draft or boot, I mean, if it's boot camp or college, I'll just go to college. And so I went to college, and of course you can only do that for so long. And then your deferments start running out, you know, and in 1965, people were starting to hear about Vietnam, and I'd already been in college just wasting a bunch of time for about 3 years. So I was getting backed up against the wall to do something. I mean, you couldn't stay in college forever and avoid the draft. And Vietnam was starting to enter people's consciousness if you were of age, you know. A lot of the college boys, the way they dealt with their military obligation, which is what it was to join the reserves. I told you this would be long and tedious, but it's almost impossible to.
No, this is interesting. I don't think most people get to hear this.
Well, I mean, it's hard to imagine, but, you know, because it hasn't, this whole situation changed, you know, obviously several, you know, a long time ago, and there, you didn't have to worry about the draft and figure out, okay, what are my options, you know, and none of them were really very good. None of my options was just go run off and play guitar. That wasn't the option. You do it for about 2 months and then you go straight to boot camp. So that wasn't an option really. And so anyway, so a lot of people, not just college boys, but a lot of guys said, I'm going to join the reserves. They had a reserve program, which was when what you did is you joined up the Navy. I mean, all of the branches of the service had a reserve program. And, but in 65 and 66, they were starting to shut those reserve programs down. And, there was an opening at a Naval Air Station in Dallas, just outside of Dallas. And me and my buddy said, we heard that they had two openings and we were thinking, well, we better, I don't know, maybe we ought to grab them while they're still there. And so we went down and joined the Navy Air Reserves because the reserve programs were getting ready to be shut down. And what you had to do was you had to do 6 months of boot camp, one weekend every month, and then 2 weeks every summer for a total. The total enlistment was 6 years. So you might only have to do 6 months of active duty, but you had 5.5 years of weekends and 2 weeks in the summer. And that was a horrible, and that's what I chose. And anyway, so that's just setting everything up that followed. So in 66, I felt really backed up against the wall. So me and my buddy, we joined up and went and did our boot camp in 66. And after that, I thought, well, I have already been in college this long. I might as well get a degree, I guess, a worthless degree. But I thought, well, I might as well do that. And so now I was free to play guitar and not get drafted, but I had reserve meetings every month and 2 weeks every summer, which really killed a big groove back then. You know, you couldn't grow your hair long. You couldn't go on tours. if you were married and had a job and worked at a white collar job or something like that, then it was a good option. You know, one weekend a month was no big deal, and 2 weeks of summer wasn't that big a deal. My first 2 week summer cruise was in Hawaii, and the second one was in Spain. So if you just had a regular job, that was a good option. But for me, it was a terrible option, you know, because it was just a terrible option. I mean, but none of the options are good. But anyway, I finally got out of school and I got a degree. It was a worthless degree. And this was in 68, because I had to lose a couple of semesters to go do the active duty. And when I got out of school, this was 68, and Dallas was, by then I'd started smoking pot, and the whole world had changed. You know, the world was, especially if you were my age, the world was a lot different in 67 and 68 than it was in 64, wow, even 65.
Wow.
I mean, it's hard to imagine the difference, because because in 65 and 66, that's when people were, unless you lived in the Village or San Francisco or something like that, most people weren't growing their hair long. And if you grew your hair long, it sounds silly to even talk about it now, because now it means absolutely nothing. It means nothing.
Yeah.
But back then, in 1968 and 67, by then people had started smoking marijuana and taking acid and stuff like that. And that was a radical thing to do, because like in 64, 65, marijuana was still dope.
So it was like 50s culture still in the mid 60s, and then all of a sudden switch flipped.
It was. Wow. Like I started smoking pot in 67, and it was a radical thing to do. Some people turned me on, and I was even a little bit late to start smoking pot in 67, really, yeah. but it was such a radical thing to do. It's hard to imagine, but it's like, because a lot of people considered that dope. You know, and nobody wanted to take dope, if somebody got turned on, if you were turned on and you wanted to turn on your friend, you had to make sure that friend wasn't going to freak out if you said, hey, try this.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and it was a real risky thing. And then I tell you what, I don't ever want to be more stoned than I got on that $10 Mexican pot in 1967. I don't know how good it was. And there was just the part of it was the paranoia and stuff. But when I finally got stoned on that $10 Mexican pot, we'd drive from Denton to Dallas to get a $5 matchbox of Mexican pot. Uh-huh. And I don't ever want to be more stoned than I got on that stuff.
That was pretty big high.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sure that it wasn't anywhere near as strong as what is on the street today, you know, but it was such a big, you can't imagine what a big deal it was to smoke pot and get high. It was so foreign to everything. And if you were, and you just kind of had to find some safe place to smoke it and we would get together and go over to somebody's apartment or ride around in somebody's car and smoke pot and listen to music. And if you were at somebody's, candles and stuff, you know, incense and smoking pot and listening to
Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young or something.
And before that, you know, I mean, I did actually, that's funny, 'cause I didn't really quite understand why everybody liked them. I'm not putting them down. That just didn't.
That wasn't your thing.
That doesn't matter. I mean, I did listen to Buffalo Springfield, which is same cats. I mean, to some degree and stuff, but whatever, you know, but.
Who were you listening to back then when you'd sit there like, and you and your buddies when you first started getting high?
Well, when all this stuff started happening, once the Beatles started smoking pot and making some groundbreaking records, I was of the age you know. And so I was interested in, I didn't like everything, but I would still listen to Muddy Waters and Jimmy Reed, but I was of the age of this generation that was where all of this stuff was, this revolutionary stuff and everything, culture, sexual stuff, for sexual freedom for girls. And it was an exciting time. I mean, but Vietnam and the draft and war and all this horrible stuff was mixed up right. I mean, well, that was even probably what a lot of it was about, but it's just hard to imagine the chaos and the revolutionary things and the things that were so radical then that are just passé now, you know. And I mean, it's like if you were, sometimes you would just get together with, you would, okay, y'all want to get high tonight, so you'd find some place to go smoke pot or at somebody's house. It was like that was a big deal to go smoke pot somewhere. I mean, that was what, and if you were sitting there lighting up and smoking, and all of a sudden you heard it, it was like, oh crap. Like, because you immediately thought it was the police, or just as bad, it would be a friend of yours that didn't smoke pot.
Oh, yeah. And then you'd be the, you know, now you'd have moral and ethical and legal.
It's hard to imagine now what a big deal it was to smoke marijuana. It was a big deal because when all of this was getting going, not everybody smoked, and certainly not everybody smoked at the same time, and not everybody liked it or was interested, and some people were straight and some people weren't straight, you know. It took a while to sort out who you could trust, not because they were bad people or dishonest, but who would freak out at the thought of being around some marijuana or something, you know. And then, of course, that led to LSD. I don't care what they say. And then that was even crazier, you know. And and so it was just a crazy, crazy time. And it sounds really silly to talk about it, but it's like those of us that smoke pot and were getting caught up in this, all of this new stuff. I mean, the Beatles changed so much with their, once they started smoking pot and the word got around and their music started changing from just some of the sappy pop stuff that rock and roll had devolved into, you know, everything, fashion changed, the sexual revolution, marijuana, it's hard to imagine now the kind of radical changes that were going on. And I mean, I'm old enough to where the first time I ever got, the first time music ever really made an impact on me, I was like barely 12 years old, maybe 11 years old.
What was that?
The thing is before that, there was no rock and roll that white kids were hearing.
Right.
But just as I was becoming an adolescent, that's when Little Richard, Fats Domino, Chuck Berry, Buddy Holly, Elvis, all of the, there was nothing. And then all of a sudden there was all of that stuff. It seems like almost at once. While I was waiting to do this interview, I was just checking some dates, and I went back and I was looking at the top 100 songs for the years of 54, 55 and 56, you know, in 54, I would have been 10. I was born in 44, and in 10, I didn't really think about music really. But when I was about 11, I started, my next door neighbor, this girl that was a year older than me, she used to drag me to these parties on Friday nights. And I didn't even want to go and dance with chicks and stuff and play spin the bottle and stuff. I didn't really want to do that, but she made me go. And so it was in somebody's converted garage, you know, and they had the record player that played 45s and the Cokes, and the parents stayed another part of the house, and we'd dance and play games and eat and all that stuff. And it was kind of fun. And then, And then we started dancing. My girl said, dance with me, you know. And so, okay, I don't know how to, she just danced with me. And so they would play these, which was like, this would have been like 55 or something like that. And so they were playing some doo-wop stuff. And there was some of the kids that were older than me were hearing some doo-wop stuff and some black music that wasn't really pervasive on the radio quite yet, but the kids had heard some of the, so the point is I would dance with this girl to doo-wop stuff, slow dancing to doo-wop stuff. And it's the first time I'd ever held a girl that close, you know, or held one period. And I was going, well, maybe girls aren't so icky after all. You know? And I associated that with doo-wop, you know, Earth Angel or whatever, whatever. I mean, we're talking late 50s, and I was going, so I was just becoming an adolescent when, and then I was looking at these lists, and Maybelline came out in 55.
I didn't realize it was that early.
It was though. And Fats Domino and a couple of people, Ray Charles, were. I was looking at these charts of a. I don't know what list it was exactly, but in the top 100 songs of 54, Maybelline had Chuck wasn't there yet, but there was a couple of doo-wop things, and maybe Ray Charles, and actually maybe even Bill Haley and the Comets were starting to kind of creep onto the charts. But then I looked at the one for 55. And now all of a sudden, now we're getting some Chuck and maybe out of 100 songs, there might've been 7 or 8 that were kind of early rock and roll or what passed for rock and roll or just some old R&B, New Orleans stuff that was, because that was early R&B was considered rock and roll. You know, it just hadn't been called rock and roll yet. And then you look at the top 100 songs for 56 and it's like, holy crap, where did all, I mean, it's just like the just from nothing practically. And I was 12 in 56 and I'm trying to remember, like when I was in the sixth grade, I don't really have any memories of music in the sixth grade. But maybe that's when I started going to those parties. But I think it was the summer in between the sixth grade and the seventh grade when I started what we call junior high school. You know, I turned 12.
And this is in Dallas.
Yeah, in Dallas, yeah. So now on KLIF, the top 40 radio station, now all of a sudden I'm hearing bop-bop-wop-bop-a-loo-bop. I'm hearing Little Richard's crazy screaming guy, and Elvis was starting to get big by 56, and Fats Domino and Little Richard, you know, and Chuck Berry and all of this. It was astounding how Bo Diddley and just all of this. I mean, all of these people were charting. Bo Diddley was on the charts. Muddy Waters was on the charts. Eventually Jimmy Reed and John Lee Hooker were on the charts. And so just as I was becoming an adolescent, that's when this music appeared kind of almost out of nowhere. I hadn't quite got over it yet, you know? And this actually is still a part of your answer to why did I go to California? I guess, because I mean, well, now I don't even remember, but that's just, everything kind of goes back to that for me. And then like hearing that music for the first time, that was the first thing that kind of set me on this trip I'm on. And the second thing that set me on this trip I'm on was the military obligation situation that I encountered when I got out of high school later on in 62. So I finished school, and by this time Dallas was like if you smoked pot and you had long hair, Dallas was not one of the better places to be.
It was real conservative.
Yeah. Which most of the country was.
Yeah.
And these days, I mean, I understand now, and I'm not the same person. Nothing's the same as it was then. But the fact was, we had long hair, we smoked pot, and I wasn't a hippie, but I looked like a hippie to a cop and a redneck, you know. and uh,
That's great.
And I thought, well, California is where it's at. It's either California, California or New York City. So in 1968, when I got out of school, I worked at the freight docks for a couple of freight docks,
sure,
like in Dallas, and saved up about $300 or something and got in a 61 Chevrolet and drove to California. And I was headed for San Francisco because that was one of the main centers of all of this stuff. But by 68, by late 68, I don't know, it was still kind of happening, and I wasn't a hippie, but I had friends there, and it just seemed like such a hipper place to Dallas at the time.
Yeah.
But I stopped off in Los Angeles to see some friends, and I had car trouble, and I ended up getting stuck in Los Angeles for about 6 months. And the only reason I really came back to Texas, I went back to Dallas because my sister got married. And I came back for her wedding, and I was going to go back to Los Angeles, but by now I'm in trouble with the military because I hadn't been to a reserve meeting in about a year.
Oh,
and
you
you can't do that.
Yeah.
And I was in trouble, and I was trying to figure out a way out of that dilemma. And I just decided, well, I might as well deal with this dilemma in Dallas before I go back, because it's no fun being out there being a fugitive and not, I still can't play.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I didn't really know Jimmy, but I ran into him a couple of times, and he told me about this psychiatrist that was sympathetic to people like me that had a issue with the military. And by now, this is 68, 69. And Vietnam was a big deal.
Oh, you
know?
Hell yeah.
And there was a lot of chaos about it, and it wasn't a black and white issue, you know. And I didn't really, but now I was in the military, you know, and all this Vietnam stuff was going on, and it was a dilemma for me. But I decided I've got to deal with this before I go back to California. And so while I was sticking around Dallas trying to deal with that, some friends of mine said, "Hey, let's go to Austin this weekend." I had some friends that were familiar with Austin. I'd never been to Austin.
Let me interrupt 1 second. When you were in L.A., were you playing at the time? What you were doing? No, you weren't.
I was struggling to pay the rent. I stayed in about six places in about 5 months out there, and and my car broke down out there. No car in L.A. is not a good situation.
Oh, hell yeah. So you were just trying to figure shit out as a young kid out there.
Figure out, survive, and then I'd got myself, and I quit as soon as I went out there. I had to transfer to a reserve base out there, which is, you can do that. And I did, but by then I was taking LSD, and I just said, I just can't do this anymore. And I never went back to another reserve meeting, and you can't do that.
Yeah.
So now I'm in Los Angeles without a car and in trouble with the military.
Yeah.
And broke and struggling and parking cars and doing all, just hustling. And I come back from my sister's wedding. Long story short, well, long story, not as long. I while I'm in Dallas waiting to go back to Los Angeles, I come down to Austin with some friends of mine for the weekend to hang out. And I think we actually came down on mescaline in a Volkswagen bus.
how period classic is that?
Well, it was. I mean, and those people weren't really hippies either. I'm not putting down hippies. It's just that we were musicians that had long hair and smoked pot and everything, but we weren't political hippies or cultural.
Yeah. I totally get it.
We were musicians. I mean, to cops and rednecks, we looked like,
you looked like the guys marching down the streets against Vietnam. Yeah.
Right. But anyway, and the very first day I came to Austin, I went, holy crap, I could just tell the vibe and the way it looked in one day. I said, I don't need to go back to California. This is all I could ever need, or at least for the time. Mm. It was a small college town. It was the capital. And in those days, in the late 60s, the campuses is where everything emanated from, mostly. I mean, you know, culturally.
Yeah.
There were musical centers in San Francisco and L.A. and New York, obviously, but a lot of the stuff that was going on in the country was emanating from the campuses, and I wasn't a student anymore, but Austin was, it was a small town, small college town, the capital. So it wasn't a rough and tumble blue collar thing, or, you know, it was just a nice little cheap college town with a whole bunch of pretty girls and a whole bunch of long haired people and some music going on. And it just seemed like a, so much an easier place to survive in than Dallas and Los Angeles and Austin. There was a community of long-haired people here, and there was more of them in a smaller place. And they, I could tell they had their thing going on down here. They had had their little community and their whole thing. They survived quite nicely in this little long-haired community. And so I said, well, I'm just going to go down there. And it took me nearly a year to actually move down here to Austin. And then I was here for 20 years and I had to leave to, that's another story, but I went to
was that Austin. University of Texas at Austin? Is that what was down there? What was the college there?
Yeah. UT.
UT, right. Austin. Yeah. Okay.
Right. And, right. So the first time I came to Austin, I mean, to Los Angeles, I didn't even intend to go to Los Angeles. I was trying to go to San Francisco. Yeah. And I was hoping to play or get my stuff straightened out up there, but I ended up in LA with car trouble, got stuck there. And I don't think I played a gig the whole time I was there. I had a guitar and an amp with me and I was trying to pay the rent and struggle. And then I got in trouble with the military. So my whole 6 months out there was just a struggle every day, you know, anyway, those were exciting times, but for me, they were really very difficult times.
Yeah,
and I ended up moving to Austin in 1970, and I still hadn't and by this time I hadn't been to a reserve meeting in, I don't know, 2 years or something, and you can't do that. And I was still kind of one step ahead of them in the, because I was moving around, and they, since I was a reservist, they weren't that familiar with me personally. And so just the red tape and the bureaucracy, I was one step ahead of them, but they were on my heels, you know, but I managed to not end up in Leavenworth somehow. I moved down to Austin in 1970 and all of that wasn't resolved. It finally got resolved. But anyway, so I moved down here to Austin, and for the first time in my life, I felt freedom. I felt, even though the military thing wasn't resolved, I said, I'm here. I'm for the first time, I'm a musician now. I'm a musician. I don't care. I'm not going to school. I'm living in Austin, Texas, and I'm going to play. And if they want me, they're just going to have to come get me and haul me off to prison or something. But so in other words, my whole life from 1962, when I got out of high school, until 1970, it was just a big, horrible mess because of the way I dealt with the military. Looking back on it, the easiest thing to have done would have just been get drafted. You know, 2 years later, I would be done with everything.
If you came back.
Well, right. But in 62, there wasn't any Vietnam anyway.
There wasn't armed conflict?
Not in 62.
Okay.
I might have drunk too much in Germany or something, you know, but in 62 and 63 and 64, it wasn't really all that dangerous out there. Not really. I mean, the Cold War was going on, but anyway, sorry. That was just it's just hard. It's hard to talk about.
No, that's a great, thank you, man. You know, sorry. That's a great friggin' story. I mean, I have a couple of questions that came of that though. The first one is, in your opinion, going from, you know, seeing this and being a part of it and in it, what was the good and the bad of all of these changes? If that's even a question, maybe.
It's right. And I think maybe the most painful one was the divide that it caused between us and our parents. It makes me really sad to think about it.
You know, I'm first of all, thank you. But my second question is directly tied to that, and it might be the answer. You were alone out there, and I've been in that situation. Just trying to figure shit out. You're in your 20s. You're fucking alone. You don't have any answers. And I didn't have anybody to ask, so it was a miserable period. And I was curious, did you like think of like calling home or asking them for help? Or like, because like, you know, I have three kids now, and you know, they pick up the phone all the time, you know, anything, which is, I'm glad, I'm grateful for that. And I couldn't do that. And I was curious, I sensed the loneliness that you felt out there, and I've been there, man, and it fucking sucks. It's really,
well, yeah, you know. Well, it was a real drag on a lot of levels, because like I didn't really get along with my dad very good. I when I was a child, I had a great childhood, totally stable. I never saw my parents even argue. They didn't drink. Nobody went to jail.
Take your time, man.
And my parents are, you know, they, my dad was born in, I guess, 1913 or something. Her mother was born a few years later. And they went through, well, he didn't go through World War I. I mean, he was a child, but they went through the 30s and World War II and
the Great Depression.
Everything.
Yeah.
And I wasn't the first person in my family. My dad had a big family. I wasn't the first person to go to college, but by the time I got out of high school, even people like my family, I mean, we weren't poor, but we didn't really have any money. But I didn't know that, because I always had a new football and some new shoes and anything I wanted. I didn't know we didn't have any money. But when I got out of high school, it seemed to me like it was maybe for the first time, it was almost expected. Well, you got out of high school, well, you're going to college then. You know, it's like it wasn't always that way. But North Texas, when I went to North Texas in 1962, I might be wrong, but I don't think I am. I think tuition was $75 a semester.
Wow.
You know, and I was paying $30 a month rent, you know, and one place I lived upstairs in this little old lady's house, I paid $15 a month for rent. Wasn't worth much more than that. But I mean, you know, it's like everything was so, I mean, I could go to school.
Yeah.
And I squandered it, and not only did as a child, I didn't have any real problem with my parents. My dad was always mad at me because I wanted to sleep late, you know, and I didn't want to go pull weeds, and I didn't want to do chores and do all, and you know, and I was a good kid, but I still was always in trouble about something, you know. But he was just trying to make sure that I didn't turn out to be a bum or something, you know.
Sure.
But it wasn't a big deal, but like once I got out of high school, and the more he never was comfortable with me playing music, really. I mean, but we weren't that close. We didn't talk about stuff, but we didn't really have any real conflicts until later on when people started having long hair and then he was wondering what the hell's he up to, you know, and he was on my case a lot, and he kind of didn't like me very much. He was disappointed, and I didn't like him. Mother was caught in the middle, and it was terrible. And it wasn't until later on that back in the, I don't know if it was in the '80s or whenever it was, like my dad and I, it was bad. And my friends knew how bad it was. I had it worse with him than a lot of people. And one day, a friend of mine that was a few years older than me was over at my house, and we were talking about this stuff. I was talking about my dad and the latest outrage, you know, And I thought my friend was going to say, yeah, what a jerk he is. And my friend said to me, he said, man, you need to get that shit straight. And I went, huh? And he said, you need to deal with that. He said, you don't want him to die with you, with you hating him and stuff. And I thought about it, and it took me a while, I guess, to realize it. And then at some point I started thinking, well, you know what? I don't know. He's kind of disappointing to me too, you know, and he ain't cool. He's not educated and sophisticated, and he doesn't like my music or my friends or what I'm trying to do. But then I was thinking, you know what? So, sorry.
No, man, you don't have to apologize for a thing. Take your time.
He and mother go through all that stuff that they went through, and then they get this kid. This is, well, yeah, thanks a lot, but I reject all that. I'm going to go, you know, I don't want to be in the Navy. I don't want to, I'm growing my hair long, and I didn't cop to smoking dope, but they would see people on TV that looked like me and was going, oh my God, you know, and it took me a long time to think, well, golly, you know, this must be really, even though they don't really the point was, is like, I realized that there was no way for them. Mother didn't really, she just was sad about it, but and that really hurt me that I was inadvertently making her sad. But I realized that there was no way that my dad especially could understand who I was, what I would wanted to do, and what I was trying to do, and how I was trying to do it. There was no way he could understand that. To him, I was just some damn worthless beatnik or something, you know, that he didn't, he wasn't hip to nothing. And here, and he wanted me to get a job at Sears or something, you know, or, sure. Or whatever, you know, he didn't want me to, cause he didn't want me to be a bum. I don't think he would have objected to me being in music if I'd have been a success right out of the gate, you know, and made money or something, but
that's not realistic though.
No, right. Well, right.
And and there's no way he would understand that.
No way to understand that. It took him a while to realize that I was serious about this stuff, you know, and the more he realized I was serious about this stuff, that's when it started getting bad. And it was just bad for a long time. I mean, I didn't think I was doing the wrong thing really by what I was doing, even though I made some mistakes, and some of the things he might have accused me of were true. Yeah. I did like to stay out late, you know, and not get up early and go to a job I didn't want to go to. I did want to go play the guitar with my pals and do all that, you know, but he didn't understand I was serious about that, and it was important, you know, and he didn't understand that. And it took me a while to realize how it was that I could understand where they were coming from about 100 times easier than they could understand where I was coming from. Sure. So if we were going to work this out, I was going to have to give like 80. It was going to be like 80-20. And I said, okay. It's okay. And eventually I started doing things that made it appear that I was having some kind of success. I mean, a lot of things he didn't recognize, but at some point, you know, early on, it took a while. I mean, certain recordings that I was on, it took me a long time to get on any recordings or do anything that he could actually look at and go, okay, you know, it took a while for something like that to happen, like being on Austin City Limits or going to New York or going to Europe or something. He was hard to impress with all that stuff. But I guess at some point we kind of smoothed it out a little bit, and probably partly because I just said, okay, you know, and I started feeling bad for them. And I felt bad for that whole, even back when all this stuff was going on and people were getting radicalized and all this stuff was going on the campus, people now don't, I mean, I was there, I wasn't political, but I knew what was going on, and I wasn't straight. I was smoking pot and I was a musician. So I wasn't any kind of radical, or I wasn't really a bad boy or anything like that, really.
Sure.
But I was just trying to play music. When you play music, you associate with a different kind of people that it's a different kind of, I mean, I love them. I've always,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, the people that I have known in my life, I love them. I respect them and everything, but it's still the subculture compared to the daytime.
Yeah. The guys wearing shirt and ties to work.
Or the blue collar guys or something.
Yeah,
the guys
right,
just
right.
Worked their ass off. You know, I did some stuff that a lot of those people didn't do, and it wasn't like horrible or evil really, but it was, and I found myself questioning. I mean, the first time I smoked pot, I went, well, I guess I'm taking dope now, you know, I mean, and that was, to me, that was yeah. a big deal. But then I realized, well, but this is misunderstood, and it's not really the, you know, like those old movies from the 20s and 30s about it. You know, it wasn't the way it was portrayed, really. You know, and some of the people that were involved in that culture weren't all monsters and bomb throwing radicals and stuff. But I found myself as I was going, I don't know, I can't relate to a lot of those people either. I mean, not just real radicals, but a lot of the hippie stuff. I thought, I don't know about some of that stuff, you know, and I was thinking, do they not even care that their parents are getting hurt and sacrificed all this stuff? And they just reject it. You know, it's like a lot of people, my generation just appeared to flat out reject everything they believed in and gave their damn whole damn lives for. We just said, nah, that's worthless. I mean, their generation wasn't perfect. There was a lot of issues that were way overdue being dealt with. There's no question about that. But a lot of people in my generation threw the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, we lost a lot of good stuff in all of this revolutionary stuff that was going on. So the personal part to me was just even though I didn't ever really wasn't that close to my dad anyway, there was several years there where it was just bad. And I felt bad just because I heard him, even if I didn't like him or disagreed with him, I felt bad that what I was doing was hurting him because I didn't want to.
Sure. Do you have kids yourself?
I never been married. Don't have kids.
So let me tell you something. If it would make you feel better, I have three kids. They're 28, 26 and 18. And I've learned I cannot tell anybody what to do. So some of this is on your dad, to be honest with you, if it makes you feel any better, because especially once a kid's 18, you have no right, legally or otherwise. You can guide them and suggest, but it's their life, man. You know?
Yeah. Well, he wasn't able to, I know what you're saying. I appreciate it. He wasn't able to see it because, you know, when I was 18, I was an idiot.
But who's not?
No, he forgot about stuff like that.
Right. But that's what I'm saying. Don't take all of this on your shoulders, yeah, man.
No, I don't, because and I don't really feel bad about what I was doing. I just am sorry that it hurt him so much. You know?
Yeah, but we all do the best we can. You know, I mean, he was doing the best he can. You were doing the best he can.
He did.
You know,
he did. Looking back on everything, he was still a good man. I was lucky to grow up how I grew up. I mean, at least until I was 18, I was lucky.
Yeah.
I was lucky. Totally stable situation. at home, at school, the neighborhood. My whole damn life was safe and warm and fuzzy.
Yeah, yeah. But wow, man, that, thank you for sharing that. But yeah, you don't need to carry all that, man. Just, it's just everybody's trying to figure out their thing. But once that, you have no right. And I've learned that because I've got three kids, and it became easier with each successive kid, even though the level of frustration that each one gave me seemed to be increasingly difficult. You know, I'm like, hey, man, I'm here if you need me. And I would just sit, and my wife and I would talk to each other, but we know we have no right to,
well, no, it is what it is, man. And that's the wiser way to do it. You know, but
what choice?
Why my dad couldn't do it.
Yeah. What's my choice?
Well, it only made things worse for him.
Right. And as you get older, you know, you want to minimize, if you're smart enough, and somehow I'm a little bit smart, I've realized, shit, I want to minimize the stress in my life, you know?
Oh man. Well, the funny thing is like, I love kids. I love them. When I was younger and had young girlfriends that had young kids, now they're totally grown now.
Yeah.
I mean, what, you know, they're 40s. There's a couple of girls, little children that I knew when they were babies, and they're my good friends, and I love them to death.
That's great,
and I'm still in touch with them, and there would be more, except some of them just moved off. But like, I love kids, and my girlfriend is a new grandmother. She's got a grandbaby, not quite 2 years old. And I love her so much, I almost can't stand it.
That's great, man. That's great.
And then Kathy Valentine was my girlfriend when I was in LA. Do you know that name?
I don't. I'm sorry.
Oh, she was the Go-Go's.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Sure.
And, anyway, I got to know her out there, and she wanted to have, she was younger than me. She's 15 years younger than me. And we hooked up, and she pretty much knew how, I didn't want to get married. I didn't want to have kids, but we hooked up anyway. And then one day she said, we got to talk. I went, oh God, those are the words no guy ever wants to hear. We got to talk. Oh yeah. Crap. I got to go. And what she said was, look, I want a family. I want a baby. I went, uh-oh, well, I wish you all the luck in the world, but I got to go, you know? And we broke up, I mean, amicably, and she ended up and getting married and having a kid pretty soon after that. And to my surprise, I've totally freaked out over that little baby. And then I moved back to Texas when that little baby was 2 years old, and I almost couldn't stand it. I would book gigs in Los Angeles really as an excuse just to go see her little baby.
Wow.
And then when, fortunately for me, when she was four, Kathy and her new family moved to Austin. So, but now she's 15, and I lost her years ago, you know, just as a playmate.
Sure.
You know, but we're still friends, but I'm just saying, I can't imagine. I don't know. I've got some out there on my deck. I've got some cacti. But that's about the.
They're a lot easier than kids.
that's about all I think I could handle. I mean, I'd be a good dad, I think, but it just never occurred to me to get married. I mean, it's hard enough to be a musician, and I was going, well, aside from that, I just never really cared about getting married. And I love, I do love kids. I get along with them. I like them, but the thought of having one, like Doyle too told me one day, said when he got his first one, he said, you got to feed him every day.
It's true. It's one of the toughest, if not the toughest thing I've had to do.
No, I can't. I mean, I can't. I just can't even. I can't even imagine. And this little grandbaby's not my baby, but I worry about her. I mean, I try not to worry myself sick about her, but she's just such a fragile, beautiful little thing, and to think about her out in this world, I go, oh crap.
Yeah. You know? And then imagine they're 18 and you can't say a damn thing.
No, God. Oh God.
And then you talk about worry.
Oh shit. If I had a girl,
my daughter's 18, man, and it's like,
oh God,
she leaves the house at night.
My deepest sympathies.
It's tough, man. And you know, so, but man, thank you very much for sharing all that. That was really cool. I appreciate it.
It's hard. I wish I didn't, I mean, if we're going to talk about what I mean, it's almost impossible for me to talk about stuff without talking about that because it just explains so much to me in my mind.
Yeah.
It's hard to not talk about it. And I wish it didn't take so long, but it's such a path that goes every different damn direction. But,
yeah. Yeah. No, you didn't.
But totally it all, cool, all of that led to Austin, I guess, you know, and then that's when my life, such as it is, lost its disorder and chaos. I mean, relatively speaking.
Sure.
I mean, that was when I got to Austin. I still was in trouble with the military, but I just said, okay, that's your problem. And I just went ahead with my life for the first time as though that wasn't a problem. And Jimmy and Doyle moved down here a month after I moved down here, and we were playing a week after that. And so I was, for the first, you know, it was only 8 years, but from 62 to 68, it seemed like a long time.
Yeah, but that's tough. Eight years alone with problems is a long time.
Well, being totally frustrated and having
no money, that's a lot of shit.
And being in, you know, but, and all I wanted to do was play, really. And yeah, it took me 8 years. And I still, with the military, for all I knew, they were going to come pick me up then.
Did the psychologist get you out of it? The shrink?
Kind of.
Like, how did it go away in the end? Or they just, like, didn't ever?
Well, he it's not like he was just going to write a letter and lie about a bunch of stuff and send him a letter. But the thing was,
you mean like they do today?
Right.
As long as you come back for your meds every month.
But I had a friend. It was in the Navy Reserves, and his parents sent him to he wasn't crazy as far as I knew, but his parents sent him to a shrink back then. And when the Navy found out that he was seeing a shrink, they said, "Uh-oh, okay. Don't call us. We'll call you."
Oh, wow.
And so I thought, okay, there's my angle, you know. And I eventually tried that, and I went to see this guy, and I said, "Oh, I heard about you." And I didn't say it like that, but it was the guy, Jimmy knew about him. I don't know if Jimmy used him or not, but so I went to see him, and he didn't like me, and I didn't like him, but he was acting like, "I ain't just going to lie. I ain't going to just write a bunch of lies so you can get out."
Yeah, you got to pay me for a few months.
Right. Well, I mean, which would have been fine, but I didn't really understand anything. But the point was, now I could say, okay, I've been to a shrink. I mean, that's kind of all I needed to.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that but that didn't really quite work yet. But it actually, to tell the truth, eventually, right after I moved to Austin, I don't think we had a phone, but somewhere I got a message that my mother, I got a letter or something. Somehow I got a phone call that my mother said, the Department of the Navy's trying to reach you. And I went, oh, great. So I called up this number and they said, show up at the federal building next week at such and such a time and day. And I went, well, I don't live, I've just moved to Austin. They said, well, we got a federal building down there. So they made an appointment. And so I leave the house and I tell my roommates, I go, well, maybe I'll see you later and maybe I won't. So I drive to the federal building and there's a Department of the Navy guys say, well, we just need to talk to you. And I had been called back to the base specifically after I'd quit going to meetings. And if they call me back, I wasn't going to not go. I didn't go to the meetings, but if they sent me a summons, I would go. And one or two of them was for a physical. And I went, and for the first time when it said, have you taken drugs? Have you done this? I started going, heck yeah. You know, and so the interview really was about, these guys were going, we just need to talk to you about your this drug use on your these last forms you filled out. And so they were real nice. They just, matter of fact, asked me about my drug usage and other stuff, I guess, you know. And then when it was all over, they read back the statement, said, "Is this true? Does this sound truthful to you? Does this sound like what our interview revealed?" And I said, "Yeah." And they said, "Well, sign here." And so I did. And they said, "Now what?" And they said, "Well, you can go. That's up to the Navy what they're going to do with you." And a couple of years later, they sent me my discharge papers, and it was a general discharge. And I just looked at it the other day, and I think there might have been some reference to drug use or something. I don't know, but it wasn't dishonorable.
But then it was over.
It was over. But at the time, I wouldn't have cared if it was a disgusting discharge. I just wanted out of there, you know. But looking back on it, and in a way, all that makes me sad too, because. But it was the thing was that we're talking Vietnam era here, yeah. You know, and that was I would not want to go to Vietnam and either lose my life or my sanity or my feet or something for something as complicated, complex and strange as that whole thing was. You know, if sometimes you have to go to war. But if I'm fighting bad, I mean, you know, there wasn't any question that Hitler had to be defeated. He had to be. And I couldn't live myself if I didn't. I'd have been scared to death like most people were when you're in war. But I'd like to think that, it'd be worse to not go than to go.
Yeah.
And so I think I would have done that had that been the case. But we're talking Vietnam. That was a very.
It was not a black and white thing.
It was not, you know, and at some point I felt I didn't want to, I wasn't all that smart, but I was going, I don't want to be a part of this. I don't even want to be in the Navy Air Reserves because I don't want to be in the military because, that was just a sad, complicated thing. And I try not to beat myself up too much over that, but I mean, because like I really respect the military and I respect police and I'm not anti-military.
Sure.
Maybe not the big shots, you know, but the military, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you surrounded by guitars if it wasn't for the military.
For those guys doing what they're doing. I'm with you on that.
Maybe not in Vietnam, but for them, I don't have a problem with the military.
Yeah.
You know, I might have been a better man had I gone to boot camp, just gotten drafted and gone to the Army and been a regular, because being in the reserves, that was just a joke. Like that was a joke. That didn't help anybody. And my college years was a joke. It was, everything was just not good. It was just a waste of time.
You got to lighten up on yourself, man. You were a young kid. You're doing the best you can tough situation.
Well, I know. And for the most part, I'm over it. But I was just looking over all your questions and I was going, this is like a therapy session. Or
Except I am ill qualified to be anyone's therapist. That's scary thing.
Well, I know. But I mean, it makes me think. But I've been thinking about not reliving all that stuff, although it does come up every once in a while because every once in a while somebody will want to interview me and I try not to, I don't usually get this in depth with all of it, you know, but it's, if somebody asks, it's like, I almost have to, if they want to know what I did or where I came, you know, just chronological events in my life. It's hard to not get into all that. You know, I'd rather not, but it's hard. I don't know how to not talk about some of that stuff. But it's your story, man.
And it's, I think everybody has stuff like this in some way or another. Like, you know, there's no easy answers and, you know, we all just like, fuck, do the best you can. You know, I mean,
I know. I was
slog your way through it. And
it was hard. And I mean, it's like almost every day of my life from the time when I turned 18 in the summer after high school until I moved down here 8 years later when I was getting ready to turn 26, like almost every day of the 8 years was like, ah, crap. You know, it was like some obstacle and some I mean, there were people that had it so much. I mean, I hate to even talk about that stuff. Sound like I'm whining because other people had it so much worse. I mean, all of that stuff was just obstacles to me playing guitar.
Yeah.
You know, and compared to the kind of hardships that other people have, it's laughable, you know, but in my own little life, it was significant, you know, but
no, I think being away and being alone and being a young kid and having no money and then having the pressure of the service and the moral dilemma of dealing with Vietnam, I think all that adds up, and you don't have the coping skills when you're 21, 22.
Well, right.
That's the
right.
problem.
And you know? Just you just can't, the cultural chaos
right.
that happened in such a short period of time. I mean, you know, there's sometimes in history where so many significant things happen at one time in history, and sometimes it's in a very short period of time. Just talking about music history, rock and roll and stuff, the kind of music that came out of nowhere in late 55, 56 through 58 and 59, in those 2 or 3 years, the kind of revolutionary music that people are still listening to today,
yeah.
it just changed everything. And that's just rock and roll. That's just a pop phenomenon. But then a lot of that kind of got watered down in the early 60s. Well, then you had Motown and soul music and stuff, and that was all fun and cool. But then you start getting into the mid 60s. And I mean, when I was a young, you know, I'm old enough to where I got to experience the rock and roll of the 50s. I was just barely old enough to experience it. But in the 60s, I was young enough to get to experience that because I was still just a little bit younger than some of the Stones and the Beatles.
Yeah.
You know? But
yeah.
I mean, some of them were older than me, but I was basically, you know, in that age group. And so I was young enough I got to have a second childhood in my, you know, I got to experience the 50s as my music, but that was as a teenager. And then in my early 20s, I got to experience all of that music and that cultural change when people started smoking marijuana and growing their hair long, and the music changed, and all these in Vietnam, which changed, just almost demolished the order of things. You know, I mean, people can't. It's hard to imagine now, but the United States was so different in 64 and 63 than it was like 3 years later, 4 years later, you know, or the difference in 64 and 67. It was so much happened in that very short period of time that just changed everything, you know, and it was, it's hard to imagine how chaotic it was. And so I'm old enough to where I remember what it was like before all that happened.
Yeah.
Like in the early 60s, girls were still kind of, however you want to put it, the pill and different attitudes, it just everything. I don't know how good it was for girls in the end, but for guys, it was, you know, I mean, golly, because, you know, it was a more uptight.
Yeah. The sexual revolution changed things. Yeah.
I mean, you know, and it was even in the early mid sixties, you were lucky to, I mean, you know, it was, I mean, people were still getting pregnant and getting married and having sex. I mean, that's, they're always doing that, but not like a few years later when you're just,
yeah, non-obligated.
Golly, I remember not long after I lived down here, I was sitting on my front porch and this little hippie girl was walking down the street and she goes, she just kind of looks over and says, hi. And I go, well, hi. She comes over and says, I just live down the street. Want to come smoke a joint? And I go, well, heck yeah.
Wow. You
know, or, I mean, just stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just, and then that led to, I mean, just,
sure.
You know, you just, it was just like, really?
That was beyond Fantasyland 3 years earlier, or 5 years earlier.
I mean, it's not like that more. I mean, it might be for somebody that's in their early 20s now, though I don't think so, because of the AIDS and so much other, the disease. I mean,
it's much more pervasive now.
I mean, back then, I mean, somehow I managed to avoid anything serious, but everything was different. The dope dealers were outlaws. They weren't criminals, really. The pot dealers, we all knew pot dealers, but they were more like outlaws than criminals,
like activists.
Almost, but I mean, they were just kind of outlaws, you know. I mean, you smoke pot, yeah, we got some, and they would come to gigs and stuff, and eventually cocaine just ruined everything. But at first, even the dope dealers, that like at all the blues gigs, we had pretty girls in high heels. There might have been a bunch of hippie girls all over the place, but a lot of the girls that came to the blues gigs were wearing lipstick and perfume, you know, and you look over and you see the outlaw dope dealers leaning at the bar, and it was just a totally different time. And there was some vice and some sinfulness going on, but compared to today, it was, I don't know, it was kind of fun and almost innocent compared to today. But it was just such a radical difference in the late 60s and the early 60s. And now everything's changed. I don't even know what the hell's going on now, but it's not like, it's not like it was before, and it's not like it was after. It's just different. But I don't know everything. You know, I'm totally lost in the modern world, really, to tell the truth. But,
yeah. Well, the only reason I'm not is because I got my kids. I'm forced to be tethered.
Well, I mean, I like there were some really exciting. It's not like I never had any laughs or never had any fun. I mean, I saw Hendrix twice and Cream twice and went to the Louisville Pop Festival, one of the very early and very only, one of the only successful hippie pop music festivals, you know, from that followed up Woodstock. And there was a few of them that were when people were doing that, you know. I mean, there was Monterey and there was Woodstock, and then there was a couple of others, and then all the shysters moved in and ruined all those for a long time. But there was a lot of fun and a lot of, I mean, it's not like I was miserable every day, but I never was able to forget about my situation for a day, you know. But it didn't mean I didn't ever have any fun or any laughs or anything. Or I played gigs on weekends and stuff. I just couldn't do anything very seriously because my situation was so, every situation I was in for 8 years was a temporary situation every day. It was all temporary.
Let's switch gears for just a minute, because you just mentioned music. And I want to talk about, you backed up some really cool people at Antone's. And I was curious if you could, if there's any interesting stories or what the experience was like with some of these folks. And start with maybe Buddy Guy.
Well, yeah, that's interesting to start with because...
Depend which Buddy Guy showed up on what night,
well,
right?
Well, that's the deal, because the first time I backed him up, it was before Antone's had a real house band. It was in its second location. The Thunderbirds were mostly on the road, and Jimmy and the Thunderbirds were mostly on the road, and they didn't really have a house band, but Clifford Antone got, I mean, it's also hard to talk about my trip without talking about Antone's and Clifford Antone. And a lot of people won't know, you know, it's like when I talk about stuff that's so important to me, every time I do an interview, I feel like, well, hell, nobody even knows what the hell I'm talking about. They don't know who I'm talking about or what I'm talking about. So it's kind of weird to, because my anecdotes aren't about Elton John and Ringo Starr. They're about people, you know, local people, Clifford Antone or Buddy Guy, or, I mean, you know, my whole life is, you know, it's been about, but Buddy, anyway, so the first time I think so. Antone's. Do you know about Antone's, that club? Do you know anything about the Antone's nightclub?
I know of it, that it's the big blues hub, and it was, you know, where so many people were showcased and discovered.
Yeah, well, it was quite a phenomenon. This guy from Port Arthur. He's a few years younger. He died a few years ago, but he was younger than me, and he grew up in Port Arthur. And
Port Arthur. That's where Johnny and Janis Joplin were from, too, right?
Right.
That's a funny thing.
He was younger than them, but but there was a lot of soul in that that town. And anyway, so Clifford moves to Austin, and I didn't know him for a while. He had been here for a little while, and he made a lot of money that he couldn't really demonstrate exactly where it came from, shall we say. And and he ended up becoming a blues fanatic, or what, I don't know the right word. And he wanted to open up this club. And so he opened up this club right downtown Austin, before all these clubs were there, and when there wasn't hardly anything going on in downtown Austin. He called it Antone's Nightclub. And he had money, but he didn't know what the heck he was doing. He opened up, he leased this building that was an old department store. It was fairly big, not huge, but it was pretty big. And it was certainly big enough for some of the acts that he brought in there. But all he wanted in there was blues, and I mean, blues and Louisiana stuff and stuff like that. And it was unbelievable, the kind of people that came there to play, because like Austin's a long way from Chicago, but somehow he got somebody. I can't remember who was the first one to come. Somehow the word got, he hired somebody from Chicago, or the word got, and in 1975, there was lots of blues guys still alive, a lot of them still alive. And somebody went back to Chicago and said, you guys need to go down and see this fella, Clifford Antone, in Austin, Texas. You need to check that place out. And so, because Clifford, he worshiped all these guys, and he would bring them down, and he would pay them good money. And if they needed somebody to back them up, he would furnish the cream of the crop blues guys around here to back them up if they need it. But so the word just got around. And so just everybody came down and played. And eventually they lost their location and went to this other crappy location, but they had to take whatever they could get. And that's when I think Buddy played at the first one in probably 76, 75, something like that. But then when he came back, this band, I was in the Cobras, we backed him. Stevie had left the band by then, but we backed up Buddy, and we were all excited to do it, and it was good. And then Antone's went to another location on Guadalupe Street, and Buddy came back, and the first time or two he came back, it was all exciting and everything, because he's a killer player and a singer and entertainer, all that stuff and everything. And Buddy was one of those people that he just has a charisma, as you know, and he can play he's all crazy ass guitar playing. And I mean, it's great. I shouldn't even be talking about all this, but he would start a song. I mean, I think he still does it. He would start a song and then go, oh, wait a minute, here's how Muddy Waters would do that song.
Yeah, he still does it. Yeah.
And I mean, we did a set. I remember doing a set at least where I don't think he played one song all the way through. And it, you know, and it was like, golly, you know,
I've seen him like four or five times, both in New York City and down here in Tampa. And it's really weird. He'll have like two or three different personalities. Like he'll have the one guy that comes out and just really rips it. Great show. Then he'll have the other guy that comes out and he's kind of angry and he's got to be fucked up. He's got to be a little drunk because he's like, I mean, he just has to be. He's just out there, you know, and he's like motherfucker, motherfucker, the whole concert. So it's really funny. You don't know which Buddy guy is going to show up.
Yeah.
You didn't have this name on your list, but I got to believe you probably backed up Freddie King.
Well, yeah, not at Antone's. As a matter of fact, right after Doyle and Jimmy and me moved here, there was this venue that opened up called Armadillo World Headquarters.
It was
it was a really important venue. It was really great. It was an old National Guard armory. As a matter of fact, I'm going to go have lunch with the guy that opened it up. I'm going to have lunch. Eddie Wilson opened up this Armadillo World Headquarters, and everybody from Frank Zappa to Taj Mahal to Bruce Springsteen to ZZ Top and Buffy St. Marie, there wasn't kind of Willie. I mean, there anybody that could play in a venue that, I mean, it wasn't a club. It was a National Guard armory, but it wasn't, I mean, the Stones couldn't have played there. I mean, sure. If they wanted to, they could have, but it was too big. It was too small for that. But other than that, it was a big concert hall, maybe 1,000 people. I don't know what it was. I don't know, maybe more, but everybody played there. And, and Eddie Wilson, but, and Freddie was playing for all the hippie joints, and he played black joints, but he also played a lot of white gigs in those days in 1970. And
I really love him, man. He's my, of all the, favorite blues artist.
Yeah, I know. And, I mean, I understand. And, anyway, so he was booked into the Armadillo World Headquarters, and Eddie Wilson, the owner, had Jimmy's band that I was in at the time, Storm, back him up. And so we backed him up a couple of nights, and then he brought him back a couple of months later, and we did it again. And this was before Leon Russell, and he started doing all the Shelter record stuff and moving in that direction. So we actually got to play with him at the very end of his Hideaway days and all of his pre-Shelter record stuff. We got to play with that Freddie.
What was he like?
I got a picture of it. Well, I didn't get to know him. I got a picture of on my wall in there let me just go and get it real quick.
Yeah, man, I'd love to see that. Very cool.
That's about my favorite picture.
Yeah, that's a good, man, when he picks up, there's something about almost every note that guy played really touches me.
Yeah, I know.
Incredible.
I know.
Any cool stories?
Well, no, I didn't get to know him. I was in another band a couple of years after that, and we opened for him because there were supposed to be three bands on the bill, and a couple of them didn't show up or canceled for some reason. I don't remember why. And so the promoter, I was in this local band, and they asked us to open up for him at the last minute. So we did. And before we played, I wasn't really used to playing at big venues like that. It was at a bigger venue here in town. And I was just wandering around backstage looking for the dressing room, and wandered into his, and he was sitting there with a case of beer, and I kind of said hello or something, people standing around, and I didn't realize that was his beer. But I walk over to this cooler and I help myself to a beer. And he didn't say anything, but he kind of looked at me, and I was thinking, I think that was his beer, not our beer.
Not the venue's beer.
Not the opening band's beer. That was his beer, but he didn't say anything, but I thought he gave me a look. But when I was playing with him, we were backing him up, and we were all scared to death because it's fucking Freddie King, you know? Yeah.
And he was a big man too, like physically, wasn't he?
He was big.
Yeah.
And we're standing there playing and we're scared, you know, and he's doing all this stuff and he does Hideaway, you know, Hideaway, right?
Yeah, of course.
And,
yeah.
And right. And so, you know, the piano part goes, da 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 da, bop 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 bop. You know that part.
Yeah.
Well, he was doing Hideaway, and I, when he did da 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 da, and on my guitar I did an E7 chord. I went bop bop bop. I did the piano part, and he looked over at me when I did that, and he smiled at me. I went, okay, that's good.
So, cool. So you were in.
I think, I don't know about that, but it made him smile, and I think it made him, because he didn't. Well, actually, he knew Jimmy. But he didn't know us, and we were just some white kids backing him up, you know. But when he heard me do that, and I think it made him go, "Oh, this might be okay," you know. And anyway, meant a lot to me for him to just look over at me when he. I mean, I'll never forget that.
Yeah.
He looked at me when I played that part.
If I said it was easy to deal with or whatever, you really wouldn't have a frame of reference.
I didn't never get to know him or really talk to him or anything.